Hi, I'm Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Hungry Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
This week I sat down with Paul Kahn, the executive chef at Blackbird and Avec restaurants in Chicago. When Chef Kahn and his partners opened Blackbird in 1997, it was one of Chicago's first truly independent fine dining restaurants. You know, it really helped pave the way for independent, thriving fine dining that exists in Chicago today. Chef Kahn's won many awards, including James Beard Best Chef Midwest and Food & Wine Best New Chef in 1999. Chef Kahn produces clean, pure flavors in all of his dishes, and he's really focused on craftsmanship. You know, whether it's curing or smoking meats in-house, celebrating local family farmers, or just focusing on issues of sustainability, he's really passionate about what he does. Fans of Chef Kahn will be excited to know that he's working on a new gastropub concept. Nothing's really set in stone at this point, but we do talk about his vision for the project in this interview. Paul Kahn didn't go to culinary school, and he has a degree in computers and applied mathematics, of all things. I started out asking him about this background.
Yeah, I did my career change when I was, I got out of college, I was 23.
Mm-hmm.
Worked in my field, which was,
Computers and applied math
and computer science, and I did that for...
You went to Northern Illinois, right?
Yeah, I did that for about a grand total of 6 months. I was like, man, I kind of knew when I was a sophomore in college that it was not what I wanted to do, but it was really, really, really a huge challenge for me mentally, so I was like, I'm going to get through this. I learned a lot of other stuff. I learned, you know, education in general, and being away from home, just how to relate to people, and the things that I pulled away from my 4.5 years in college, I think, were much more important than how to grind numbers together. You know, I learned a lot of management skills and a lot of stuff that, and there's a ton of great cooks out there in the city. I mean, a ton. But, and there's a ton of, you know, new chefs. You know, the kid at Schwa,
Michael Carlson,
there recently, you know, great guy. You know, Food & Wine,
Best New Chef,
yep. Which is awesome that they went off the radar a little bit, and but all of a sudden he's going to be faced with, the phone's going to be ringing off the hook, and he's going to have to hire more, so the whole dynamic of what he does on a daily basis is going to have to change, and actually, unless you manage it right, you get to the point where 2 years down the road, you're not allowed to cook anymore. It's all about going places and doing things, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's really tricky to manage your career and be smart and make smart decisions. And I've seen guys that win that award, guys and gals, I've seen them, they're like, you're like a deer in the headlight.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everything's changed.
Sure.
You know, everyone wants a piece of, everyone's coming in to critique you, you know, it's not just...
Sure.
I mean, we were fortunate. We kind of, Blackbird opened at a time when there was nothing going on for small independents except for the fine dining temples. You know, Trotter was there, and who else? In 97, you know, Spring opened after, but it was pretty much just, you know, corporate stuff and small mom and pop places, and you know, we lucked out. I think we hit a niche that Chicago really needed, you know, good seasonal food, you know, that we care about, hopefully, obviously, you know, work every day on the menu, and a casual environment. You don't need to go spend 4.5 hours and $300.
Right.
Which is, you know, has its place, but I think on any given night you can have a morsel of food by us, even at a back, and you can have a morsel of food at a, you know, True or Alinea, and they both taste great, and they're both complex and interesting and seasonal. And
yeah, I mean, that's the thing I loved about your restaurant when I first moved here is, you know, you were doing, and I wrote a review of this at one time where I said that, you know, like I had gone to Trotter, I think, maybe a month before, Charlie Trotter's a month before I came to Blackbird, and this was when I first moved to Chicago, and I, you know, of course I love Trotter's, you know, Trotter's doing great food, and always has, and always will, you know, there's nothing you can say. I mean, there's so many people who've come out of his kitchens who are doing, you know, he's responsible for quite a lot.
Yeah.
Like you said.
He's kind of responsible for the whole food scene in Chicago,
yeah.
To be honest with you. But anyways.
Yeah, I mean, before all of that, I mean, it was Le Francais and Trotter, and that was it, really, I think. And you know, and then I came to eat at your place, and one, I was just amazed by the value, mm-hmm. you know, because at the time you guys were keeping your appetizers under $10 and your entrees were around 20-ish. And
it's creeped up, but yeah. you can't help it. I mean, it's...
Yeah, you got to pay for the food costs.
So expensive. I think it was a little... When was this, a year ago?
No, this is...
Oh, long yeah, time ago.
I mean, I've been to Blackbird a few times. I've probably been like 3 or 4 times now. But,
right.
This is the first time I went, probably like 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
And...
yeah, I think we were like 23, 24, 25 for entrees, and appetizers were 10, 11 at most. And now it's 12, 13, 14 for appetizers, yeah. and 25 through 32. I mean, for years, we didn't go above 30.
Right.
That was a big... I don't think we went above $30 for an entree until... maybe 2003.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, the price of fish when I started, you can get walleye pike for, you know, $4.25 a pound, $4.50 a pound. Now it's $8.95 fillet price. But everything, I mean, you know, and I'm not going to use things that I don't believe in, you know. One thing I've tried to do is do everything we do in that kitchen and the way we run that restaurant with a conscience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, so much goes... I mean, we're currently working on a composting program, which has taken a while to find the right deal, where all of our usable food scraps go to a compost, which I need to compost for my garden anyways, you know, and recycling, and you know, so for so many years everyone's been saying organic and local, and you know, a lot of people have been lying for a long mm-hmm. time. It's like, it's the buzzword, and they say, oh, we use a lot of organic and local, and believe me, in 88 I was going to the Chicago farmers markets, and I'll tell you exactly who's been buying local mm-hmm. for a long period of time. You know, I mean,
yeah, I know you're really involved with the Green City Market as well. I know that.
Yeah, at this point, I'm involved in just the capacity that I buy a ton of stuff from that market every week. I mean, I figured the best way to do it is to show your face there every Wednesday morning. I'm there between 7:30 and 8. You know, the only other guy that I see there... I mean, there are other chefs that buy, but Bruce Sherman from North Pond. Is a super seasonal local chef, and he's there every week, and you know, we see our customers and we see people buying stuff, and it's really great advertising for the restaurants. But regardless, you know, I guess I've just tried to... I guess my biggest goal is to try to live a normal life and try to avoid... For the most part, I mean, that's all I hear from people now is, oh, you're such a celebrity. This, that, and the other thing. And believe me, I am probably the furthest thing from a celebrity of anyone.
Well,
you've
turned down a lot of good opportunities, I would guess, you know, because
yeah.
you've stayed in your restaurants for the most part. And
yeah, I mean, there was a year, 2 years ago, I did a lot of traveling. And this year, I try to pick 5 or 6 events, all generally around the same time, and go cook in other cities and see what other chefs are doing. And you know, the travel does do a lot for creative growth, and it's fun to, you know, I owe a lot of the success of the restaurant to meeting, you know, Tom Colicchio at
right.
an event in Kohler, Wisconsin that you know, what was my story with Tom Colicchio? When I was the best new chef, I met him. I didn't know who the hell he was. Some guy came up to me at this big party. He goes, hey, how's it going? You know, and I go, good. I shook his hand, and he looked familiar, but I didn't know who he was. And, I said, he said, how do you feel about this whole thing? And I go, well, I'm pretty excited. You know, it's a little, it makes me feel a little angry in a certain way. I can't really describe it. I said, it makes me feel like I'm at like a punk rock show or something. And to a certain extent, I want to just grab a chair and smash it over someone's head because there's so much superficial bullshit involved. And I know that's every day, that's life, that's doing business. And Tom Colicchio said, yeah, I know what you mean. And you know, and he introduced himself, and I was like, wow, cool. And he's a super normal guy. And he said, when I'm in Chicago, I'll come to your restaurant. Mm-hmm. Promise. I'm like, great. 2 years later, he was in Chicago for the restaurant show and came up to the kitchen. I was back there cooking, and he goes, told you I'd come. And he had a great meal, and like a month later, he was the headliner at this first annual food and wine festival in Kohler, Wisconsin, and he invited me to be one of the chefs that does demos, and it was a lot of coin for not a lot of work. And it was, I mean, just that kind of simple networking, just being a normal human being to people. And I'm just as interested and as excited to meet chefs and see what makes them tick, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, it's funny that you mentioned Tom Colicchio, because I was thinking about Chicago and how it's kind of diverged. There's sort of this camp where of like simple, clean flavors that, you know, you're a part of. You know, I think Sean McClain, especially at Green Zebra, has been a part of.
Yeah.
I started thinking about other chefs who are part of that, and I thought about, you know, I thought of Tom Colicchio, I thought of like Suzanne Gowen. You know, but at the same time, you know, Chicago's got this duality where now we have guys like, you know, Omar at
Science Food,
at Moto, and you know, and Grant even. And I wouldn't say Grant is their Science Food. I think he gets lumped into that bunch.
Well, both him and Graham at the Peninsula. I think Graham is the least Science Foody of them all.
Mm-hmm. But, well, Graham said they stopped doing. He said they stopped doing a lot of that stuff, like the Pop Rocks and things like that, because he didn't want to be known as kind of like a one-trick pony. You know?
Right. He's a great guy, too.
He is a great guy. I interviewed him. But, yeah, there's like this duality in Chicago. And
yeah.
You know, I wonder how you felt about that or how you feel about the Science Food and as somebody who doesn't necessarily cook that way.
Yeah. You know what? I think it's awesome for the city, to be honest with you. You know what, I think it's bringing the city a lot of attention, and I think that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on a purely business level, I think that's really important to bring. You know, I think the reputation of Chicago as a food city is, there's a lot of rumblings right now. There's a lot happening. Like, you know, we're kind of poking around to do another project, which we'll get to later, but...
How much can you say? Is that the gastropub idea?
It's the gastropub, yeah. We may sign a lease this week.
Okay.
So, and there's a... We did an article in Food & Wine, you know, the whole photo shoot, McGillicuddy, and, which is going to come out in, I believe, the June issue. So, hopefully we'll have signed the lease by then, otherwise we're going to look like idiots, but it's a certain amount of balancing. But regardless, you know, that aspect of it... you know, anyway, so we went and looked at a space on Division over there by where Fortunato used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Division just west of Damon. And I don't think we're going to take a space over there. It's just, it's like Disneyland.
Yeah.
At this point, there's two tapas places open across the street from each other. It's just, you know, they're going in fast and furious there. There's going to be 5 or 7 new restaurants that open probably next year or this year on that strip there. And
yeah, it's not like Randolph was when you were like the bridge decliner and that was it.
right. You know, I think there's a lot going on in the city right now. There's a lot of rumblings, a lot of barriers have been broken, you know, barriers with what Grant's doing and what Hamaro's doing and with what we did at Avec. You know, I wouldn't say that we were the first to do small plates, but I think we were the first to break down a lot of barriers with, well, actually, I don't know anyone that did it really successfully before Avec opened up, but I mean, did it with, instead of doing scaled down dishes, somebody that is doing real food to share, you know, real, it's not tapas there, it's just communal dining, and the whole concept is real congruous, so it works, you know?
Well, I think about how, like, charcuterie is so hot now, and yeah. You guys were doing cured meats and charcuterie before anybody, yeah. Kind of, you know, in that sense.
Yeah, we do try to beat the curve a little bit, but... So from that angle, I think the Science Food guys are really important, and, you know, Chicago is... So many times in the last 2 or 3 years I've seen, you know, Chicago, better food city than San Francisco. Which, you know, who gives a rat's ass? I don't know if it is or it isn't, you know. But definitely garnering us a lot of attention, and that's something that Trotter did initially, and, you know, Rick Tremonto from True brings the city a lot of attention. But I think more importantly, what people are accepting of, you know, their palates are much more mature. It's much more like New York, much more international flair, where pretty much anything goes, and you can, if you're good at it and you run a good business, you can make it work. So from that standpoint, I think it's good. From the standpoint of, you know, these guys are the darlings of the press, you know, and that's good for them. I would never want to, you know, everyone needs press. I mean, I'm sitting here doing an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Press is an essential part of any business being successful. You know, you gotta get people in your door. But I feel like there are much more important issues that the press should deal with. You know, it's always about what's new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, not to get on my environmental high horse, but I think there are a lot more grand issues that I've supported over the years that I continue to support. You know, we just had a film screening for a group that supports biodiversity. That's for labeling of foods, so we actually know what's in the food. You know, GMOs are a huge topic right now, and worldwide, and America's definitely, because we're all about capitalism and money, we've allowed much too much of that stuff to go on. So issues like that that don't get any press, I think, are way more important. And I'm not saying that the science food guys aren't paying attention to that, but I'm saying that for the most part, the press ignores people that cook with a conscience and that really truly support local farmers and that really truly cook seasonally and try to raise the consciousness of the people that come to the Green City Market and the people that come to our restaurants. And, you know, the growth that I've seen through that little Green City Market, you know, Abby Mandel, who started it, and Bruce Sherman and Rick Bayless and Tracy Vall, the chef from Frontera, myself, those guys are all more so involved than me. And Bruce has continued to do a ton of work for that market. What that's done for small farmers around the Midwest, I think, is far more important, and people need to know that than what than a guy that's making a sphere with a fruit sphere with CO2 inside of it or whatever. And sure, it's fun. Fish is a huge problem right now. Fish, the price keeps going up because the technology allows the Japanese and all these people that just consume so much fish to get fish where they never got them before.
Mm-hmm.
And the size keeps going down, and more and more goes on the endangered list, and it sucks. So those are really, that's kind of my thing with the science food. And it's like, man, for a couple months there, everything I opened was Moto this, Moto that, and I'm very happy for him.
Sure,
it's important
sure.
for his business, but I think the press is a little diluted.
Sure.
And I'm gonna probably get in trouble for that. No one specifically, but
I think there's been a little bit more of a. I mean, I'd say Ruth Reichel, Gourmet, is focused on sustainable agriculture.
She's
trying to bring
guys.
Some of that.
She loves the local guys, which is great.
But you're right. I agree with. But I think there's more. There's a new movie. I think The Dirt on Farmer John. I just came out.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's no surprise. I mean, one of your culinary inspirations is Alice Waters, right?
Right.
And so she's working. I know she's been very involved with the school lunch program, and
she's really the one who started the whole thing in America. With cooking seasonally, and I mean, we didn't even have a clue what that was about. The little high-end French restaurant that was doing the same menu year-round was sort of a staple at that point. And then, along comes Alice and taught people about, pure simplicity, beautiful little cherry tomatoes from one of her growers with great olive oil and snipped herbs. And, here it's one of the best things you'll ever taste.
Yeah.
Just that kind of attention to seasonality and stuff. The whole thing with her started, I was actually... when I was a junior in college, I had a buddy that turned me on to hopping freight trains,
mm-hmm.
believe it or not. And we actually, he was the head of off-campus recreation, and I went on a winter camping trip with him, and it was like, what am I, crazy? It was in the Boundary Waters. It was, like, at one point it was 52 below. We had a minimum register thermometer, and whole deal, like vapor barrier liner in the tent and in your sleeping bag, otherwise your sweat would freeze, and really extreme camping. But when we were on that trip, he told me that he had loved to go on freight hopping trips around the country, and so he invited me. And on the first trip we rode through the Northern Rockies, and then got kicked off in Spokane, Washington. So there were three of us, and me and another buddy hitchhiked to the coast and then down the coast of California, and we stopped in Berkeley to do laundry. And I had read a little bit about Japanese. I was into food. Kind of went out of my way to go and have lunch or have dinner at the cafe.
And this is kind of, I feel like I've heard, this is like your kind of road to Damascus moment or whatever.
Exactly.
For you when you...
Yeah, which that would have been about 80, maybe 87, 86. And I was like, man, I love this. And I'd like to try to do this someday or something like it. And actually, after I started cooking... when I was working with Rick Bayless, he wanted to do a restaurant with me, and kind of what we built it in our minds as was Chez Panisse in Chicago. And as it turned out, I think his idea was a little different than my idea. And I think Rick's an incredible guy. I just bumped into him yesterday. The bottom line, I didn't want to work for I wanted to see if I could do it on my own, you know. And, you know, knock on wood, we've been fairly successful, but...
Did you meet Alice Waters on that trip?
Or I did not.
You did not?
I did not.
You've met her since, I would guess, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, she answers my calls when I call Japanese to get a reservation or something. Yeah, actually, she has eaten in Blackbird several times and kind of heard, you know, one person or another, hey, this guy's doing it right in Chicago, and... She's come to town to tour the Green City Market a couple times, and every year when she does, we had a cocktail party for her at Blackbird, and then Avec opened, and she came there, and she's coming to lunch at Blackbird both years, and she's amazing. She eats the most. She orders like Caesar salad and pork chop.
Of course,
she's like about.
She's looking
the,
for the standard to see.
She's
if
looking for the no. She's looking for the just simplest.
Well, she's looking to
thing.
See if you're doing the food right, and that's going to be with the things that are unassuming. And
I guess so. Yeah, but she's driven. She's,
you know, you mentioned Rick Bayless, and mm-hmm. I know you spent some time with Erwin Dressler as well.
That's it.
And yeah, and you know, but you know, you look at their food, and although I definitely see some influences from Erwin, and you know, I was looking at your menu today, and I know you had some chili pepper, I think, on the on your menu at Blackbird, but
chili pepper.
Like an arbol chili, maybe, or something.
Oh,
like
yeah,
that.
It's been a little tartare.
And but generally speaking, I don't know that, you know, your cooking is almost completely separate from those influences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm curious how that came about. I mean, I would guess some of it was Alice Waters, and but you know, the dish for me I had a couple years ago, I think, was you know, and it's still on your menu in some form, is like your seared diver scallop, which you have, I think, with like Marcona almonds and black truffle and Meyer lemon, and
right.
I think at one time there was a poached egg or a hard-boiled egg on that. And, you know, it's got like seven or eight different things, and you look at it, and intellectually I go, I'm not sure, you know, but then you eat it, and it's unbelievable, and everything goes together. Like, where does that come from? Like, how do you know to put those things together? Especially as somebody who, you know, you didn't go to culinary school. And,
right. Well, you know, kind of part of it is I think that good cooks have a really innate sense as to what goes together. You know, you say... I mean, it's like it starts at, you know, what grows together or what certain cuisines cook with in certain seasons, you know, and that those ideas are built in your head by reading, you know. The most basic tomatoes and basil, they grow together in the garden. Basil keeps the pests away from tomatoes. They work together perfectly. You kind of start with that, and I think by just reading cookbooks and being an enthusiastic cook, you learn those combinations. And then I think beyond that, it's a certain sense of, like, when we, and really everything that we do at Blackbird on the menu is a collaboration between myself, my sous chefs, cooks that are up to the task. It's not like I'm this, you know, guy wearing a 7-foot-tall toque, and I come in and I say, okay, here's the new dish, do it exactly like this. If you don't, I'll kill you, you know what I mean? It's more like, hey, you know, we have a blackboard down in the prep kitchen, and right now it probably says menu changes to work on. There's like four or five items. We try to change, you know, like this week, Dylan, our sous chef, soon to be chef de cuisine at a new restaurant, who's been working for me for 5.5 years, he's out of town, so maybe we'll change two things on Friday of this week if we can. We're busy as hell with parties and wine dinners and things like that, but... and we're a little short-staffed, but normally we try to change two or three things a week, and there are certain periods during the year where there's nothing new, there's no new product, and we're just like, well, we got a week off, we're not changing anything. But we sit in the office and you say, you know, like I said, the Blackbird says right now, you know, in the protein column it says probably soft-shell crabs, wild salmon, which I heard recently that it's going to be a horrible year for wild salmon because I'm not exactly sure why. I know they're really... tightly managed fisheries, but one thing or another happened, and there's not going to be a whole lot of wild salmon this year. But, you know, just for example, it says those, and then in the other column, it's like vegetables, and it's like fresh green almonds. You know, we pretty much have everything that's available in spring so far on our menu. We used to wait till it came around locally, and we were just so screwed up. You know, it all comes at once. You know, I mean, first market starts, and there's green garlic and rhubarb, and maybe a little bit of peas, and I mean, we had to get a jump on it. So we get the stuff from California, and then it's much, we ease into the local stuff. So we kind of, the seasons kind of are like a sine wave, you know, they're a little up and down for us. But, there's cherries will be coming down the road, green gauge plums, and a few more things. And so we just kind of play connect the dots, and it's like, you know, what works? It's like, okay, green gauge plums. We get this great prosciutto from this guy in Iowa. Does that sound good to you? Plums and green tart green acidic plums and prosciutto? Yeah, that sounds pretty good. And then we say, well, what protein do we want to work with? Well, we don't have a quail dish on the menu, and it's a great protein. We make money off of it. It's meaty. People always love it. It's consistent. So we do a Bob White quail with prosciutto and green gauge plums and maybe brown butter and white balsamic or whatever. And you build a repertoire of flavor combinations, and certain things work and certain things don't. And, you know, we're not beyond trial and error. We try something new, and, you know, we taste everything before we put it on the menu. And if it doesn't work, we either tweak it or we ditch the idea. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like right now we have, we're bacon crazy now. I mean, we've always been pretty pork driven, and certainly this new project is, this gastropub idea is going to be a lot about pork and oysters and things that kind of I can see myself belling up to the bar and having a pint of Saison DuPont or Quack or some great beer, which is a great passion of mine.
Yeah, I love hoppy.
Me too. But right now we're making Canadian bacon, applewood smoked bacon, prosciutto, pancetta, and guanciale. So we're making four kinds of bacon, and I'm sure the feds are going to swoop down on us on a helicopter, but we drag an old refrigerator up on the roof, and we cold smoke and hot smoke, and we found the plans online. And
nice.
So we're doing, and it's all cooked stuff, so it's within the guidelines of the city's cured meats program. So we're making great house smoke products, and I think they're like our pancetta, I think, is far better than the best product that you can buy, you know, Molinari from San Francisco. I mean, this stuff just kills it, and we get the pork belly in, and, you know, pork belly is like maybe 230 or 240 a pound, and, you know, there's some man work that goes into it, but we're getting the best prosciutto you can, or best pancetta you can buy for $3 a pound versus $7 a pound, and we probably use 1 2-pound or 2.5-pound log a day. So it adds up, you know.
Yeah.
And you got to find ways to make money, like we talked about earlier. Everything has continued to go up in price, and, you know, a restaurant like us, we can't.
Yeah, it's tough to be an independent, right?
I mean, yeah, we can't charge $40 for a plate of food. And
was the feds kind of, or the, you used to joke about the feds, but wasn't that part of the issue with UBEC, why you guys had to take some of the salumi off?
The person who was in charge of that aspect of the health department was not very approachable. And now I've been told, and we're actually working on it with both restaurants, to get the certification that you need to do it.
Because I know I talked to Paul Viron. I interviewed Paul, and
uh-huh.
He said that, yeah, it's really tough. Like the county and the city are, you know, it's like, who knows the rules, but in the end, you know, they aren't very open to these kind of things.
Yeah, they don't want meat hanging up for 3 months at 50 degrees.
Even though it's been done for hundreds of years. Since medieval times.
You didn't want to get me going on that whole thing, but, we do want to comply, and, you know, we're doing some house cured meats at this point. I know, like, John Coletta, you know, went through the process and got certified, and, you know, when the old person was in charge there, it wasn't doable for us. Just they wanted a separate room and this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, we run really clean operations and get really great organic product for the most part, you know, and that's what really matters. So,
yeah, I was in Cleveland, like I said, and I was at Lolita at Michael Simon's place,
yep.
And you know, the cool thing is they are carrying a lot of their own meat in house. Mm-hmm. And I had this lamb haramari, I guess, which is like lamb prosciutto, basically, mm-hmm. It's cinnamon and all spice,
awesome,
with salt, and man, you know, I can't think I've had a better cut of meat in a while. Like, it was just, it literally melted in your mouth.
Wow.
You know, and the thing is, they cut it on one of those Van Berkel slicers. So they don't, you know, the no motor thing, so you don't get the residual heat.
Yeah, we have one of those at Avec.
It's, you know, hopefully, you know, I definitely understand what they're doing and their, you know, consumer protection, but,
uh-huh.
You know, hopefully they'll be, you know, they get more educated on the issue because, I mean, you're such good food, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's important for the the food culture in the city too. Paul Brown's doing a great job, huh?
Yeah, you know what?
Great guy too.
I love talking to him. I mean, just, you know, the thing you love more than anything is, like you said, guys are going around lying about, you know, I cook seasonally, blah blah blah. You know, you see a guy like Paul who, you know, he's pickling, you know, he's making like jams, he's doing all kinds of this stuff, and it's like, you know it's not lip service because you see it. You go in, and, you know, he's making his own vinegar, and you know it's that's craft, and that's what's worth talking about or what's worth pursuing. Is your wife a big food person?
She is. Contrary to, you know, she's a her she was a healthcare professional.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a high-powered administrator for non-for-profits, and she worked with surgeons and doctors a lot, and she kind of got really burnt out on people in that field. They're pretty demanding. And all along she had been a serious yoga practitioner, so she's been teaching yoga now at a bunch of studios around the city, and we have a little studio in our house. She's been doing that for, I think, 4 years now.
Okay.
And so, you know, she should be like a vegetarian who doesn't drink and PC, and she's all about, you know,
incense and patchouli all over the house.
Some of my most seminal, you know, the first time I went to Europe, to France, we went together and kind of explored that together, and she's got a great palate, and she really is hugely critical of what I do. I mean, she loves what I do, but when she comes in the restaurant, everyone kind of panics, like, it's Paul's wife, man. Because they know the next day they're going to get an earful if something wasn't right. But
you need an honest voice.
Mm-hmm.
You need an honest voice, I think.
Totally.
I read a lot about how you've been very good about, you know, counseling, like, some of your chefs on maintaining relationships in the restaurant industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is such a tough thing to do.
Yeah. You know, my thing is, at this point, deep down inside, does something say, would I like to be considered like a Grant Achatz or like, one of these guys? And, you know, something inside me says, yeah, that would be cool. Because I really do think we do really, you know, really solid food. And I think given the correct facility and the opportunity, we could do food. I mean, Grant's insanely talented.
But you got a James Beard. Don't they think I'd like to be Paul Kahn?
I guess so. They're different schools, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
One school's the sort of simple. I don't know. But
I know it's hard to look at yourself sometimes and say, oh, you know. And I
yeah, especially when you're never happy with. I mean, I think in the almost 9 years we've been open, there have been two times where I've looked at the whole menu and said, man, everything is right on. And then probably a week later, it wasn't right on anymore. You know what I mean? But
what wouldn't be right on for you?
I when people are eating, I look at like all kinds of things. Like I look at how a dish eats, like when they break into something, how it collapses on the plate, or how the whole thing eats. Is it just turn into a gigantic pile of shit, or is it eat real structured and they get all the flavors the way they're supposed to? I look at, you know, like right now there's a couple, 3-4 items that are holdovers from winter. And, you know, there's no more new product coming in, so we're holding back a little bit. But, you know, we have a dish, an incredible dish on the menu. It's Arctic char, and it's with, we call it an agridoo, but it's like a pickled, it's like sweated shallots, pickled golden raisins, and toasted hickory nuts, which we get from a guy from Wisconsin, homegrown, a forager. Hickory nuts are kind of like pecans, but much more subtle in flavor and much more complex. Subtle and more complex at the same time. And, you know, extra virgin olive oil. And then that kind of gets spooned over the top, and underneath is this ragu of just simply grilled scallions and these mushrooms called... there's this place in Sebastopol, California called Gourmet Mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard about them.
I don't know if I have.
They grow like 5 or 6 varieties of mushrooms. This one variety is called... They call it, it's either Velvet Piapini.
Okay.
Is one name. The other name is, they grow on some, like, black poplar mushrooms or something. They grow on a particular tree. And they're little, you know, small caps, real intense flavor. So we do this ragu of those mushrooms, a little porcini oil that we make. And then on the side of the plate, we do just a really velvety puree of butternut squash and a lot of brown butter. And the dish is so simple, yet there's so many complex flavors going on. You know, the like natural spiciness of the hickory nuts. The mushrooms are real earthy. The butter and the puree is real rich, but there's just a little of it on there. Anyways, it's a great dish, but I would have liked to have gotten rid of it a week ago because it still reads kind of wintry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that we're always fighting time. You know, the clock is our enemy.
But that, I guess, is what makes a good chef, right? I mean, like I said, you always compete against yourself, and
totally.
You can't get, you know, complacent.
Yeah, right.
What's the vision for the gastropub?
Well, I mean, do you know the whole gastropub phenomenon? You know what it's about?
I know what's classified as a gastropub nowadays, but you know,
it happened in the early 80s. A lot of breweries went up for sale, not a lot of breweries, a lot of pubs in London went for sale that breweries had supported, and they couldn't afford to do it anymore, you know, economics changed. And right off the bat, I forget what the name of the first one was, but young chefs started buying them and doing really solid quality food in a pub.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the place, it's a bar with great food.
Mm-hmm.
So my vision is to do a bar with great food, which I think the Hop Leaf is a good example. It's, you know, straight ahead Belgium. I think it's good food.
Yeah.
I'd like to do. There's a place in Montreal called Pied de Cochon.
Mm-hmm. I've read about it.
The foot of the pig. And I've eaten there a few times, and it's very robust, sort of peasant food. A lot of pork, a lot of foie gras. I feel like every time that I eat there, it's like they should hand you a toga at the door, and you put the toga on, and you have this completely over-the-top meal, and you gorge yourself, and then you go vomit, and then you're done. And that's not what I like about it. What I like is this sort of level of just, you know, decadence. Like the idea is really elemental food, like unadorned, like a whole Dover sole, or a nice chunk of sweetbreads, or. A lot of pork preparations, a lot of great egg dish, you know, I don't mean like fried eggs, scrambled eggs, but I mean things with poached eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of see it as there's a place in New York called Momofuku that I totally love right now. It's like a little noodle shop where the guy worked at Kraft.
Mm-hmm.
And he does, like, in a bowl, he'll do noodles with a chunk of pork belly, a poached egg, and like a great broth dumped over it. And it's just like a great steaming bowl of goodness. It's kind of Momofuku meets Prune meets Pied de Cochon. And I want to have a place where I want to have great oysters, like a constantly changing selection of oysters, great tap beer, you know, craft beer, and, you know, things that are like bar food, but the kind of bar food that I would really love to eat, like incredible homemade French fries fried in beef fat with like we made a chorizo aioli. We just made homemade chorizo and then added it to mayonnaise and sort of strewn that over a little bit. And it's like, it's a little over the top. It's like probably got more calories than you should eat in a week, but it's really, really good.
That's what going out to eat's all about.
Yeah, but it's really good. So that's kind of the idea, you know, sort of.
No Belgian horse fat, though? I hear that's the...
I don't know anything about that. What's...
Well, Jeffrey Steingarten did an article in Vogue years ago about how he basically heard that Belgian frites are done in horse fat.
Hmm.
And so he had a buddy smuggle some horse fat back when he was in Belgium. And apparently what they did was he basically did a taste test kind of thing where he had, like, you know, I think he had duck confit, you know, the duck fat oil, and then he had, you know, this Belgian horse fat, you know, a bunch of different oils, and just tested, like, batches upon batches of fries. And I think
the horse fat won?
I think the horse fat was, like, the best, but, you know, it's one of those things where we clearly don't have a lot of horse fat in the United States.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, that might also bring the feds down, I don't know, but...
Yeah, but, you know, to be completely honest with you, the way we've done both restaurants, a lot of the, you know, you had asked me earlier what, you know, where my cooking style came from, and I think a lot of it comes from the space that our architect creates. You know, I never really did clean, focused food before, and then I got involved in this partnership, you know, just really by, number one, because I had a little bit of talent, and the other because I was, thank you very much, because I was willing to put my ass on the line. And my partner Donnie knew this guy, Thomas Schlesher, who's an architect, and Thomas had to, you know, look at the space, and and had a design for what they said they wanted to do, and I think it was a great design, and as it kind of came to fruition, I really thought, man, what I wanted to do for food is not what's going to work in this space. You know, it needs to be really focused and really clean, and that, as much as anything, helped. You know, there was a gal who worked for me, her name was Shira Harris, she was my first pastry chef, and she had worked for Charlie Trotter right before that, and she had a lot of tools, and she really helped me a lot with the savory food, and had a lot of great ideas, and she was a big, big, played a big part in the direction of the food early on. You know, so I think, and then Avec, we kind of told him what the concept was, and you know, he's just consumes himself in, you know, like we said at one point, we had an idea, we wanted to open a bakery, with a bakery in the central part, and then a restaurant surrounding an actual production bakery. May have been a little too grand of an idea, but it didn't end up working out. But he immersed himself in, he's done a lot of projects in Paris. Mm-hmm. He's a very accomplished, I mean, he's built complexes and skyscrapers, and he's really an amazing architect. But just that sort of seamless detail from, you know, from the time you walk in the door to the time you leave, the way the space is utilized, and I think that's really played an important part on the development of our food. So a lot of it is, you know, we have a space in mind, and he gets the floor plan, and we talk about the idea, and through that creative process, him, myself, and Donnie, and Edward Chetan, who does all of our wine. And I think he is responsible for sort of teaching me a whole new aesthetic about, I mean, and every, you know, I look at that place and I go, man, it works. I can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you drive by there, it's jam-packed with people, both restaurants, and they both work. It's a miracle, you know?
I know you're a big music guy.
Uh-huh.
What are you listening to right now? Well, what aren't you listening to? Britney Spears?
Yeah, never. this week I probably bought 10 CDs/albums. I always buy, my system records sound a lot better. And I think the biggest part of my record, I probably have maybe 6,000, 7,000 records in the basement between my wife and myself. And the biggest part of the collection is jazz. I mean, that's sort of the funnest to collect and the funnest to find like a little gem and listen to it. But I really like everything from real country. You know, by that I mean like
Merle Haggard.
Like Merle and Waylon and...
Thank you.
And Willie. And, you know, like I just bought this week, I bought the new... There's a new Willie Nelson thing out. It's him covering some woman's song, but it's on this label called Lost Highway. So I bought the new Willie Nelson album. I bought an album by this kid who I saw open up for Wilco many years ago named Josh Rouse,
mm-hmm.
who's like a
mm-hmm.
modern pop guy. I bought the new Flaming Lips.
That's a good album.
It's good.
Listen to that. Although I like the last one, Yoshimi just rocks the world.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. I bought an EP for the new Ray Davies album that's coming out, the guy from the Kinks.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Which is really good. I mean, I heard it on NPR. I bought an album by this... Another thing I heard on NPR, this guy, he's like a soul... Sounds like Sam Cooke, but he's a... he's a guy from England.
Oh, okay.
It's incredible. It's great.
I was thinking of... the guy I was thinking of is... I don't know if you heard of Ray LaMontagne.
No, I have not.
Ray LaMontagne, man, he's like my obsession, like my newest obsession. Not new in the sense of I've been listening to him for about a year. His album came out last year. It's a great story about this guy. He was literally working in a shoe factory in Maine, like Hush Puppies or something like that,
mm-hmm.
getting up at like 4:30 every morning, working like 17-hour days.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really ever play music or anything like that. Woke up one morning and heard Stephen Stills' Treetop Flyer. Was blown away. Never heard it before.
Nice.
Called in sick that day, went and looked for the album, found the album, listened to it,
uh-huh.
and then decided he's going to devote himself to music and performing, even though he had never, you know, really played guitar or anything. So a year from like that day almost, he got his first gig, he was playing guitar. Incredible voice though, like he harkens back to like Otis Redding, like just that old soul feel to his voice.
Wow.
You guys play a lot of music in the kitchen during the day when you're prepping and stuff?
Like crazy. Like I would say our
do you guys fight?
No, there's different personalities that like different stuff.
This concludes the first part of my interview with Paul Kahn. As we move into the second part of the interview, we started talking about a wine dinner he was preparing for.
It's fun to taste the wines, and I mean, that's definitely a... I kind of miss that when we go back to it. You know, wine, you know, the whole dining experience, wine is a definite part, you know, definite area where we get inspiration for the food. I mean, I think with the Chambal Mucini, we're going to try this smoked eel and sweetbread dish, which sounds pretty good to me.
Sounds awesome.
Because she said, you know, I called the purveyor, and she said, yeah, I got eel. And actually, it turns out it was Karen, the chef at Avec, called her and asked her to bring in eel. So she brought in eel, and Karen's incommunicado today. She's got other things on her plate, so the eel, she's like, you want the eel? I'm like, yeah, I'll take the eel. So we're going to brine it tomorrow morning real early, and then we're going to smoke it on the roof in our little rooftop refrigerator.
Nice.
So it'll be pretty cool. So
that sounds cool.
Yeah. But
I had my first sweetbreads at Blackbird, actually.
Yeah, we get these great organic sweet, like normal sweetbreads you can get for like between $5 and $6 a pound, and we spend like 14 to get these. I mean, they're just like, I never smelled sweetbreads that actually, I never knew why they were called sweetbreads.
Mm-hmm.
When you open the cryogenic package, it's like the smell is super sweet.
Oh, yeah.
And I never knew that, because the ones you always get are just completely just doused in blood, and you have to soak them, and these you don't even have to, you can take them out of the package and blanch them in a court bouillon. That's how clean they are.
Nice.
And, you know, again, they come from good animals, so pretty happy about that. But
the Green City Market we were talking about earlier, and sustainable and all that good stuff.
Yep.
You know, when I was in Cleveland, of course, they have the Great West Side Market there. Obviously, I know the Green City Market, you know, is very stringent about purveyors, and you know, we're looking for people who are, you know, at least doing sustainable and organic if possible.
Yeah, and actually, Bruce Sherman is the head of the board that goes to the farms and decides if they're allowed or not, which is pretty key.
Is there enough to sustain sort of like a full-time market like that for Chicago? I mean, is that something that we should do?
That's a strong question. We always talked about that, and definitely always, when I was, you know, involved in going to all the meetings, that was a definite push, and I think to a certain extent there is. I mean, the more...
I know you guys are doing the zoo in the winter little bit.
The more revenue that these guys can generate, the more of an opportunity they'll have to, you know, to set up hoop houses and grow. You know, like the best spinach you can get probably in the whole world comes from a guy in Wisconsin that he grows in hoop houses in the winter. Snug Haven Farm, I think, is the name.
Okay.
And, you know, they wrote out in Gourmet like 10 years ago, and it's like sweet like candy. It's amazing. And I think the more money that a market generates, the more opportunity these guys will have, and they'll take advantage of it. You know, a lot of the farmers in like Northern California, where it gets pretty darn cold, they do like, you know, multiple layers in their hoop houses. And you know, there's a ton of guys that grow enough and store it properly. Like, believe me, like Nichols Farm could give you fingerling potatoes year-round, or shallots, or a lot of stuff. So
root veg.
Yeah, root veg. So I think, you know, and actually for the last 2 years, Homegrown Wisconsin, which is, I don't know if you know Homegrown. It's a cooperative of about, I don't know how many farms, but at least 20 from around the Madison area, and they do a huge business in Chicago. And, you know, it's farms from huge organic factory farms that do a lot of business for Whole Foods, like Avalanche Organics, and there's a whole bunch of them that do a ton of stuff that Whole Foods buys. And actually, my produce guy on the market will bring me stuff in boxes from farms that are in that co-op. So they're really getting a lot of steam. But then there's really small farmers like this guy Rink to be, who used to be in charge of the whole thing for a while. I forget his, maybe he's Avalanche, I don't know, I get it confused, but he grows, you know, Charente melons and beautiful baby greens and all kinds of interesting things like that. And 2 years ago was the first year that they went, that we got a sheet every week, and they had stuff every week, and I still can get potatoes and onions and shallots and a lot of stuff from them, and we do. You know, Paul Verant buys frozen strawberries, which he does with this dessert, like organic sweet cream ice cream with these frozen strawberries over the top, and it's one of the best things I've ever tasted. Mm-hmm. It's incredible. So I think as more chefs start to buy more local, you know, really, really buy more local and seasonal, those guys, I think the reality of a year-round market becomes really, really possible.
You know, the other thing Paul and I, kind of along the same vein, Paul Braun and I talked about was this concept of, you know, I mean, I know you're a James Beard winner, and God love James Beard, what a great man, but what I don't like is, you know, when I'm writing an article on my time in Cleveland, one of the things I'm talking about is, you know, how, you know, just like in art, you know, our culinary consciousness is still very coastal, New York City, mm-hmm. California, and God, you know, Chicago's on the map. It's been written about more than it ever
Michael
has
Simon
been.
Michael Simon not be nominated for a Beard Award, that really pisses me off.
Yeah.
He doesn't even talk about it anymore because he's so infuriated by it. It's a joke.
Because he's in Cleveland, you know, and people don't take it seriously. But, you know, I would love, you know, how about the idea of a Beard House, but not Beard, obviously somebody from Chicago, but where you didn't always have to go to New York to cook for these dinners, you know? Why not in Chicago? Why not have a central plate, you know? It just seems like it's an idea that should be coming.
Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, and not to diss anyone, but every... When's the food section, the Tribune, Wednesdays?
Yes.
Every Wednesday, I read the paper in the morning, and I go through the food section in about 12 seconds. But every week is a syndicated article by Wolfgang Puck. Why don't they go a year out and say, pick 12 chefs from Chicago, or 12 chefs in the Midwest, or no, 12 times, you know, every week. There's enough, and have them write... do a recipe and write an article and support the local. It just seems completely absurd to me that, you know, we're getting recipes for Cal Cuisine from Wolfgang Puck. And yeah, he's a big name, but why can't we have a recipe from Charlie Trenner one week, Rick Bayless the next week, you know, Paul Varant the week after, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems like, it is coastal, and it is who's on TV, and it is who has a lot of cookbooks out. And, yeah, the Beard thing's weird. I just do what I do, and like I said, try to be nice to people. And I don't know if it's purely on culinary merit or if it's a popularity contest or what it is, you know. But you know, it's great to get it over with and win it. So
I mean, I think it's like anything. I think you. I mean, clearly you cook well. There's no question about that. And you know, but just like anything, I mean, you know, if you're a senator, you're in the running for president, and so you were a Food and Wine Best New Chef, you know, you're on the map for people, you know, it's like,
right.
and I think that's just how it works. And
it's true.
You know, a small group of people end up getting in that 5%, and then, you know, they get a shot at it. But, I mean, you know, as a testament, I mean, you know, and what I was trying to say earlier was, when I had eaten at your place 2 weeks after Trotters, the thing I said and the thing I wrote about was this idea that, you know, like you said, you know, 10 years ago, Trotters was the only game in town. You know, it was one thing to do like a prefix for $100 or whatever and that kind of thing. But it was like, when I ate at your place, it was this revelation that, you know, there was this next generation of chefs who were cooking at the same level, mm-hmm. but you were pricing it at a value level. You were letting people make choices about their food rather than to have to, you know, say, oh, well, Charlie told me this is what I got to eat, which, right. You know, I respect the artisan. I have no problem. I agree. Mm-hmm. Nobody tells Picasso what to paint.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, it was just this idea that, you know what, Trotter wasn't the only game in town anymore. Now, there were these other people who were still cooking at that level, but it was more accessible. And,
right.
And that's what I liked about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, not to say that it was us alone, but it was an important step for Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, big time. And I think it opened the door for, you know, just small independents being successful and getting a lot of press and making some money. It opened the door for a lot of guys. You know, hopefully a guy like the guy at,
Carlson.
At Schwa, you know, we actually have a strong food community now, and there are foodies that'll go there and bring wine and sort of go into virgin territory and not hesitate because mm-hmm. they heard from me or they heard from some other chef that went there that it was really great. You know, and it's amazing the power that chefs have, and that was the whole idea behind the Green City Market. It was really failing, and Abby Mandel came to a group of chefs, Rick Bayless, myself, and Sarah Stegner, and said, help me out. You know, let's start a board, let's get the chefs collaborative involved, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and it worked, you know? And it's amazing, you know, people at the market look at you like, what are you buying? Why are you buying that? I'm like, you know, they're fucking fingerling potatoes. Why are you buying those? And I'm like, because I like these. I've cooked them all, and these ones I like to taste the best. You know, they have they're a little waxier and they have a real intense flavor. Whatever, they think it's some, you know, cooking and food and restaurants is some mysterious romantic thing, but it's not at all. And
it's labor. You yeah. guys will do the work that a home cook won't do.
Yeah.
Plus, you have five other guys to help you out, or
right.
women to do it, and so.
Right. But yeah. But I mean, it's amazing what chefs are capable of. You know, it's like some kind of voodoo over people's eyes that you know that we actually know what we're doing.
So. Well, you know, it's funny though. You know, now as I've talked to a lot of chefs in the last few months, the one thing I keep coming back to this analogy. I remember there's like that movie Blow with Johnny Depp, and there's like the scene where he's talking to his dad, and he was talking about how he's like really good at being a drug dealer, and his dad says, "You know what? You're bright. You would have been good at anything you did." I get that same thing with chefs. Like I talk to a lot of these guys, and it's like you just get the feeling they would have been good at whatever they did. You know, like you talk to a guy like Graham Elliott Bowles. Talking to Graham, he's talking about, you know, maybe in 5 years I'll just quit and go into like politics.
He really wants to go into
you know,
politics.
He's been reading books and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And you know what? You believe it and you think that he could do it, and there's no question in your mind he could do it. And, and I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, to be a strong, successful, independent restaurateur takes a lot. You know, I mean, you know more than anybody. I certainly don't know. But, you know, if you can do that, I think it's a testament to that you can do anything. You know, it's not just about cooking. It's about whatever it is.
I like Graham's point with that. You know, I've gotten that conversation with him, and it's about, and I feel the same way, that a lot of people take cooking and restaurants and food way too seriously. There's so much out there that's so much more important. I mean, I think it's important, and you want to excel in your field, but... And I think a lot of people take themselves way too seriously. It's like, dude, just chill out. I mean, give yourself a break.
It's food.
I mean, it's food. That's the bottom line. And I think I think that attitude comes out in what Grant does. And it's just like, you know, it's just, it wears me down, the you know, super swollen head, you know, whatever. I mean, it is an art, and there are a lot of guys that are really great at it, but I also feel like it's taken way too seriously.
You know, you can use that to your advantage, like you said. I mean, if you want to talk about sustainable issues, and
right.
you know what, that's a good opportunity to do that, and the
right.
things that are important will come through.
To get on my soapbox.
And then the other, you know,
right.
somebody has to.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, too, I think, is that, you know, if you... I mean, you say it's not important, but at the same time, I mean, food is tied to sustenance, which is our basic existence. And
right.
so if somebody is doing a sublime version of something that can make you live, you know, there is some importance to that. I mean, and you know what I always say, and the thing that I want Hungary to be more about is, you know, it's not necessarily as much about the food as what food does. I mean, food is the backdrop that inspires a career. It's the backdrop that brings family together, that brings friends together, you know, celebrations. And that's what's really more important about food. And so, you know, that's probably where the importance lies.
That's sort of the Alice Waters key that I got on the bandwagon, you know, in the beginning. Her statement that food is about, you know, sitting across from the table with ones you love and relating on some level and breaking bread is really what it's about. And I couldn't agree more. I think that's huge.
You know, there really is nothing better than spending time with friends and family over good food. And, you know, I'm really excited about Chef Khan's new gastropub concept, and I'm looking forward to spending more time with friends and family there. We talked a little bit about his vision for this project and what kind of food he's going to be serving.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to just going completely pork crazy at this new place.
Do you guys have a name?
Gastropub? We do not. You know, all the gastropubs in London are like the... They're like two names. It's like the something and the something, like the dove and the artichoke, or they're crazy names, which is kind of cool. And then I thought about just doing some short, sweet name, like calling it Pig Bar, which is stupid though. It sounds like it would attract people that I wouldn't really be interested.
It'd be like Hogs and Honeys or something like that. Yeah. People would be dancing on the bar.
so we'll figure it out eventually. Mm-hmm. Like I said, once the whole deal is signed, which it isn't yet, there are no guarantees at all.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what the you know, what the, once I see the design, and I mean the space kind of reminds me like a miniature version of Zuni in San Francisco. It's a triangular shaped space with a lot of glass, and we have a couple ideas of
speak about a good Caesar salad. I had a really good Caesar salad there. I mean, that's, they have that, just that very elemental, like big, the big shave of the Parmesan, and the, you know, it's very good.
Elemental is the key. Like, there are a couple places that I think, I really think what they do is so simple and cool. Like, 4th Street, and was it Maine?
Mm-hmm.
You ever seen a menu of theirs?
No.
The guy's name is Sam Hayward, and it's like, just like the, it's like a protein, and then like a, you know, like a, and they specify where all the ingredients are from. It's like a protein and then an accompanying item, and that's it. And it's like a, like in pubs they always have sides, you know, like you can get a side of this or a side of that. So I feel like you can do sort of incomplete stuff. It doesn't have to be, you know, completely composed plate. And I don't really want to do that. I'd rather do just like a perfectly cooked piece of fish with some great shaved raw porcini mushrooms or something, some other, you know what I mean, just really beautiful. And
that's how people eat at home. Why, yeah, you know, why
exactly.
not? Yeah, you know?
We got to figure out a way to do it so that it's reasonably priced.
Mm-hmm.
That's the other trick, you know.
It's got to be accessible. You know, you knew you were going to die, or you're on death row. You know, what would you eat? You know, I envision it be like.
What? That's an impossible question to answer.
Impossible question.
Does everyone give you an answer on it?
Everybody gives me an answer, but there's always a really long pause and. You know, it's a genuine, honest question because people don't have an answer for it. They, you know, and they come up with something. But I don't know if it tells. I think it tells you something too. Sometimes, you know, like some people will be like comfort food. Some people will be like, you know, I'll have my 10 chef buddies come over and cook a 10 courser or whatever it is. You know.
You know, I would say honestly, something, and this may be a bullshit answer, but I'd say something. Incredibly homey but incredibly elegant at the same time, like you know, like some wonderful I was thinking of something that I made for an Italian dinner that we did once, but like great great whole wheat pasta with beautiful olive oil and some shaved white truffles over the top, and a great, you know, Barolo or so, whatever wine pairs up with that. And I think more the, you know, it, or another one would be maybe a pizza from Pizzeria Bianco.
Mm.
I don't know if you've ever had Chris Bianco's pizza.
Yep.
I had a pizza there. It was actually at Suzanne Gone's wedding. And it was definitely one of the five best things I've ever tasted. Best in my adult memory. And it was a pizza. And I actually in the summer make pizzas on my grill.
Mm-hmm.
On a stone on my grill. But I have a wood grill in my yard and it gets up to like 700 degrees. And it's Reggiano, shaved red onions, and pistachios and olive oil, and that's it. And
mm-hmm.
it's an incredible.
Awesome.
So I'd say maybe one of Chris's pizzas, maybe just some simple whole wheat pasta with truffles shaved over it, and a great, Barolo wouldn't be the wine for that, maybe a Dolcetto or a Barbera. And definitely it would be more about who the last meal was with than what the last meal was.
Sure.
I mean, for sure it'd be my wife. And or my friends, and or my family, you know.
Yeah, the other question I like to ask is, you know, if you were throwing a dinner party, who would you invite? You know, and it could be living or dead, because...
Oh, that's impossible.
Yeah.
Who would I invite? Charlie Parker. My favorite play is this play called Copenhagen, and it's about a conversation that it was a meeting... pre-atomic bomb in World War II between Niels Bohr and, I forget his first name, but Heisenberg. The Heisenberg Uncertainty
Principle. Yeah.
And it was about why one, Bohr was from Denmark or whatever country that was...
Plum pudding model of...
Yeah, the Nazis were occupying his country and Bohr was a German and went to work on the bomb for the Germans. But anyways, definitely a famous physicist of that caliber. Maybe Niels Bohr would be a good one. I mean, you got to see the play or read the... Actually read the... Only time I've ever read in my whole life. But I read the play. It's really fascinating.
Do you miss the Mac and computers at all? No.
No, I mean, I miss the mental stimulation. You know, and I think I get that to a certain extent listening to music, believe it or not, you know. But it was always a huge challenge. Now I feel like the challenge, sometimes cooking is mentally stimulating, but more it's like trying to organize everything and coordinate everything and do everything is more of a challenge. It is a mental challenge, but it's a different kind of mental challenge. So I think at times there's a part of my brain that lays dead right now. I mean, I can still crunch numbers a little bit and do some calculations in my head, but I'm far away from it. But I've always been interested in nature and in science and in math and stuff like that. So who I have there? I said Charlie Parker, Niels Bohr, my wife, of course, she'd be first.
Sure.
My dad, who's been dead for a few years now.
That brings up my real last question before.
Okay. There's a couple others. I mean, I wouldn't mind having. There's a ton of musicians that I'd love to, you know, sit with and pick their brain.
Yeah.
And a ton of chefs that I'd love to sit with and pick their brain. I wouldn't say someone like James Beard or someone like that, but or Jean-Louis Caledon. I didn't know him. But I'm sure there's a few chefs out there that I've always loved everything that I've ever read about Andre Soltner.
Mm.
He'd be a good one. Who knows?
Yeah.
Michelle Bra. I don't know.
You could go on.
I can go on and on.
Yeah. It was funny when I asked Doug Stone, Hot Dogs, about the last meal question. It was like, at first he's like, you know, I think I'd have, you know, and I forget what his first thing was, but then he just kept going. He was like, I had choucroute from here, you know, I'm going to get this chicken from here.
Like, choucroute's a good one. Actually, I had grilled chicken at a place in Montreal that was in the gourmet issue about Montreal, and that would definitely be on the top 10 Last Supper list. It was so, so good.
Yeah, it was a good
charcoal
issue.
Charcoal grilled chicken, and remember when that came out, it was in Montreal. Montreal's a great food city.
Yeah.
Last question.
Last question, because I didn't get to it and I wanted to. I know I read a lot about, you know, your dad was like a deli and a smoked fish kind of deal. I'm just curious about your food memories with your father and, you know, growing up and you know, did that have an influence on you going into what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, number one, I have a lot of earlier memories, but one of the reasons why I got into it was my folks got divorced when I was 13, maybe even younger, maybe it was 11. But, you know, divorced fathers, they come pick their kids up and they go out for dinner, or they go to a ball game, and we did all those things. And it was lucky because my dad was a workaholic, and if it weren't for that sort of guilt, my parents wouldn't have gotten divorced, and that doesn't make sense, but I wouldn't have spent as much time with my dad as I did. So it's kind of strange, but we went out for sushi and for food all the time, and my dad loved food, and he really, really started me on it. But the things that I remember the earliest were going to my dad's deli and always having a corned beef sandwich, a bag of Jay's potato chips, and a Dr. Brown's cream soda, you know, pickle. It was a classic memory, or pastrami. Just ate so much of that stuff. And probably the biggest one was when I was in high school, I worked for my dad. He had a little smoked fish house called Fans Fishery. And then after that, the Village Fishery. And he had these old school wood ovens, and he'd grind the fish, and they'd put them on racks, and then these rods that had pins on them. You'd skewer the fish and then hang them on the racks. And they'd wheel the whole racks into the wood room and light a fire in there and close the door, and the fire would go out and they would smoke. And the next day when I'd come in, my dad would always pull the cart out and he'd take a smoked chub out, and they were still warm. I don't know if you've ever had a really good smoked chub. They're in the herring family. Cold, they're not even acceptable.
Yeah.
Warm, and we would toast up a bagel and put a little cream cheese on it and red onion, and like tear the head off the chub and rip the skin off and just flake that meat on there. And, you know, smoky, briny, incredible. I mean, that's definitely probably my best food memory ever. And, you know, I obviously miss my dad. He's been dead for years now. But I think about, I get that question all the time, or, you know, what's your best food memory? Or that's definitely it.
Yeah.
I mean, having fried matzo with my mom when I was a kid, or pancakes and sausage for dinner on Wednesday nights was a good one, but that one by far is the best.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate it.
No sweat.
I really do.
No sweat.
Thanks for listening to this interview with Paul Kahn. I know it was a little bit long, but I hope and believe it was enjoyable for a lot of you food fans out there. You know, we're always looking for suggestions, and if you think it was too long or you have other ideas and suggestions, please drop me an email at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. Or you can just go to the website www.hungrymag.com. Join us next week for an interview with Nader Salty to find out how a medical surgeon becomes a restaurateur.
Three, two, one more time.